Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
I actually met my wife on CatholicSingles.com, if you can believe that.
Really?
And about... Yes, I had never done that before. Didn't have any problems with dating.
Natalie and Aaron met on CatholicSingles.com after they realized that they needed to find someone who shared their faith. Meet other faithful Catholics on the original Catholic dating site. Download our app today for free. Looking for a way to build daily prayer discipline? Seen the rise in mindfulness meditation, but not sure if it is possible to meditate in a way that's consistent with your Catholic faith? Just looking for a way to breathe new life into your existing prayer routine? No matter what you're looking for, Hollow is here to help. Hollow is a Catholic prayer and meditation app that helps users deepen their relationship with God through audio-guided contemplative prayer sessions. From meditations on the daily gospel, to the rosary, to daily examines, Hollow has something for everyone. Hollow is the number one Catholic app in the U.S. It is free to download and has permanently free content, but you can also check out all of the premium sessions for 30 days, risk-free, by signing up at www.hollow.app/breadbox.
Welcome to Good Things Radio, a lifestyle show about activating your mind, body, and soul to become fully alive. And now, your host, Brooke Taylor.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to Good Things Radio. Hello, my name is Brooke Taylor. This is episode number 202 and Holy Week. A few years ago, a popular priest we all know and love, Father Mike Schmitz, shared a beautiful reflection on the days of the week this week, the unnamed days of Holy Week leading up to the Easter Triduum. And it was via the Franciscan Sisters of the Eucharist in Duluth, Minnesota. I tried to find it again. I couldn't get a landing page, but I'll just share. I just think it's so beautiful. Something to reflect on, an intentional approach to each day leading up to Christ's Passion. And it begins with Palm Sunday, Procession Sunday, they call it. Will I walk with him into Jerusalem? Then Monday, they named Extravagance Monday. The woman poured out the oil, the nard, in abundance. Then Tuesday, Compulsion to Completion. Jesus has a fire in him that he is impelled to do the Father's will. And then on Wednesday, the day of aloneness, not just the aloneness of Jesus, but also Judas. Day of aloneness, knowing what he was about to do and the isolation that sin brings to us. So meditating on that. And then, of course, Thursday, the body is given. Above all, the Eucharist given to us at Holy Thursday Passover meal, the Last Supper, the sacrificial gift of Christ. Friday, impotence, the all-powerful God who has made himself powerless. Saturday, night, darkness of the tomb, the coldness of death, and then Sunday miracles, that all he did points to this one thing, our King of Kings, the conqueror of death. So just a little seed packet, a starter there of how you can use this week each day to meditate, and even in retrospect too, but I just love that. And I wish you every day of this week and the Easter season, just a downpour of God's grace. One of the things that I've been praying more this Lent are the sorrowful mysteries of the rosary. And whenever I get to the third sorrowful mystery, the crowning of the thorns, I always pray for those who are experiencing an agony in their mind, mental illness, depression, intellectual challenges. And today's show is going to cover that with a deep dive. That's the topic on today's show. Blessed to bring back an all-star guest because while we're focusing a lot on the current crisis, this pandemic that we're all in the midst of, there's also a mental health crisis possibly looming with that. And I don't think that's been covered enough. So we're going to have a lengthy conversation that's going to unpack all of that, and in the end, bring about great hope. That's always our takeaway and our purpose here on the show, and learning a lot in the meantime. So let's jump in.
I want to talk now about the toll this pandemic is taking on us. Even those with solid mental fortitude are being tested, and not just from the quarantine that we're in, the isolation, but fears of the virus, I think, the grief already that we're experiencing, losses, people that we know, and the economic strain. And I don't need to go into the litany of factors because we are living it. We know. But I do want to examine right now how we might remain strong and take a look at an anatomy of hope, if you will. And to do that, I'm happy to introduce one of the most popular guests of all time here on the program. A two-part series we did a year or two ago ended up being one of the most downloaded few episodes of GTR ever. So very happy to welcome our guest, University of California Irvine health psychiatrist who specializes in adult psychiatry, the author of several books, including The Catholic Guide to Depression. His work has also been featured in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, on CNN, NPR, NBC, and more. Delighted to welcome Dr. Aaron Cariotti to the show. Welcome.
Thanks, Brooke. It's great to be back with you.
Well, thank you for coming on because I've really been concerned about this mental health component. So thank you for being willing to address this.
I'm so glad that you're speaking about this issue on your show. And I know that all of the listeners out there probably to one extent or another are struggling with something related to mental health.
There are various stressors, I think, for all of us, as you pointed out. As a clinician, how concerned are you about the mental state of people right now and that kind of spiraling, not just in the micro in our homes, but macro across the world?
I'm very concerned. A lot of the public health focus right now is obviously on the people who are contracting this virus, and especially those that are requiring ICU level care in hospitals. But we're hearing less about other people that whose health is being impacted, including mental health. Although I was pleased to see that this is now on more and more people's radar screens. There was a very nice op-ed in the New York Times about the mental health effects of this virus and soliciting feedback from readers about how this is affecting them. My own vantage point here at the hospital, here at UCI, I've seen several warning signals of mental health, I hesitate to use the word crisis, but certainly significant mental health impacts on our patients. We had recently two people attempt suicide while in our emergency room. And that's not people that are brought into the emergency room because they recently attempted suicide. That's something we see routinely at a hospital like ours that has a large psychiatric service. But these were people who, while they were in our emergency room, made an attempt on their lives. Fortunately, they didn't complete suicide. We were able to help them. But those were things that we haven't encountered here in the past. That was a sign to me of the level of stress that many people are encountering. And those who already have struggles with an underlying mental illness, I certainly worry about them being particularly vulnerable during this time. If their access to mental health care is reduced because of the turmoil in the healthcare system, or if the stresses that are being caused by the worldwide upheaval are simply too much for them to manage. So I am very concerned without being alarmist about this, because I think there are creative and constructive solutions out there that are available. And I think more and more people are paying attention to this. I also, at the same time, don't want to overlook or minimize just the scope of the challenges and problems that people are facing.
I saw a study that during the Great Depression, there was a surge in suicides, especially during the first year. Should we be prepared for something like that here, or is there a way to flatten the curve?
I hope that we can. To what extent we will be able to do that, I think will depend on how society responds to the mental health needs of our population. Some data that I saw recently suggested that with the uptick in unemployment, there's a strong correlation between unemployment and opioid misuse, I should say, and abuse. And so already being aware that we have this opioid crisis, this opioid pandemic in the United States of addiction and people dying of opioid overdose, I'm very concerned about the rise in unemployment and the effect that that's going to have on people that are not only now at home without a job, but more socially isolated. And
it's interesting that you said that
economically, right?
Well, I was just talking to my husband about that because I haven't seen any data. And I said, do you think that things like drug abuse and addiction are going to go up or down because there's less availability and funds, which funds are arguable an issue or not because people will steal or do whatever, but they have less access maybe to their dealer or to the social constructs that make it possible. Maybe that will help or maybe it'll make it worse. So what you are seeing, though, is an increase because there's despair. So then there's that snowball effect that comes in.
Yeah, the access issue is an interesting one, but something tells me that street dealers of drugs are not necessarily going to abide by stay-at-home orders or quarantine recommendations. So I think that's still that's a very good question. I think it's still an open question whether sort of the current state of society is going to make access to these drugs more difficult or not. That could be one factor that mitigates some of the potential difficulties. But I don't think that we've I don't think we have enough data to know yet what we're going to see in that regard. And I think there's reason to believe that at least certain people will continue to have, well, they may not have access to toilet paper at Costco. They might continue to have access to drugs of abuse. And certainly alcohol-related problems, I think we'll see an increase of those as well, given that grocery stores are still open and people are still going to have access to that substance. So I remain concerned about the drug addiction and drug abuse issues during this period of time.
I want to explore Haiti. I had a chance to visit several years ago. It was after the earthquake, and one of the things that struck me was the poverty. I mean, they have staggering poverty, but Haiti has one of the lowest suicide rates in the world. So they have those factors of people, infant mortality being high, people getting sick and dying, poverty, obviously the crisis that happened where their homes collapsed, homelessness, and their suffering has been intense and sustained. Yet when you look at Haiti, are their numbers so low? I'm curious, what can we learn from cultures like what we see in Haiti?
It's a great question. Interestingly enough, in the United States, suicide is not that closely tied to income. So at the very lowest end of the socioeconomic scale, if you're in grinding poverty, that's going to increase your risk of suicide in a modern industrialized Western nation. But once you get above that, those who are well off, wealthy, have more or less the same suicide rates as those who are much less well off. And I think what you see in a country like Haiti, where poverty is sort of endemic, you might say, is that while they don't have the same economic resources that we have here, they may have stronger social ties and social connections, right? So we have an epidemic of loneliness here that many developing nations don't have, at least to the same degree. So people may not have a lot of material possessions in Haiti, but they seem to have one another. They seem to be connected to their families, to their neighborhoods, such as they are, and to their local communities in ways that we struggle to find here. And we know that loneliness is now being understood more and more as a significant risk factor for depression and a significant risk factor for suicide. And the Surgeon General a few years ago warned about the epidemic of loneliness in the United States, and similar concerns have been raised by the National Health Service in Britain. So as Mother Teresa pointed out, there are various forms of spiritual poverty that we struggle with in the US and in other wealthy Western countries that she didn't see among the poor in India, where she was working with material poverty. So I think to address what's going on in our country and in other places around the world, we have to think in terms not just of material poverty, as important as that is to address, obviously, and worry about the virus spreading through those communities that don't have the capacity to wash their hands because they don't have soap, they don't have hand sanitizer, idea of physical distancing is impossible in the slums in India or in Haiti. But on the other hand, we have to think not just about material poverty, we have to think about the kind of spiritual poverty that we struggle with in the United States and Great Britain and Western Europe, of social isolation, of loneliness, that could be exacerbated by these laudable efforts to try to prevent the pandemic spread. And these are important, but we also have to look at the downstream effects of what it does to certain vulnerable individuals who are already struggling with loneliness or isolation when we tell them to stay home. And perhaps they're in an age bracket that is not used to connecting via Skype or Zoom or video chat technologies. They just, the millennials will be able to stay in touch with their friends. College age kids will be able to stay in touch with their friends because they're used to these kinds of technologies. But what about people who can't afford an iPad? What about people who don't know how to use these technologies to stay connected to family and friends? I think those are folks that we have to start paying more and more attention to and thinking of creative ways to include them in the circles of communication that other people are kind of quickly getting up to speed on and learning how to use in these times. We have to remember our neighbor down the street who isn't part of those conversations.
And those in nursing homes that now are no longer able to receive visitors. And let's talk about that. Is there a protocol that can be implemented to help speak to that, those that are not connected?
So I would like to see some grassroots efforts that will involve volunteers, that will involve some Silicon Valley technology type folks, of raising funds for inexpensive tablets with apps that are designed specifically for people that are hearing impaired, visually impaired, that need large buttons, a simplified design. I know there are people up in the Bay Area in California, my own state, working on these kinds of things, but we need to get them piloted and out there in usable form so that we can get some of these devices into nursing homes, so that we can quickly train up nursing home staff to show nursing home residents how to use them, so that our grandparents, so that those folks who maybe don't have families can be dialed in to communities that can visit them at least virtually during these times. Obviously, these are vulnerable populations when it comes to the virus, so we don't want to be bringing in more and more people to those nursing homes that could potentially expose them to something that could get them very sick, particularly in that age bracket. But then just leaving them to languish there with only their professional caregivers at hand, I think is also not an acceptable solution. So let's get creative, find ways to help them utilize technology in ways that connect with their needs and in ways that overcome some of the barriers that they may encounter, being intimidated by, you know, looking at an Android or an iPhone device and sort of not knowing what to do. Look, there's a lot of creative people in this country that can help out with those sorts of things. And there's a lot of this can be done at the level of ordinary citizens, just volunteering time, energy, some money, some old devices that they don't use anymore to be repurposed for these kinds of things. I think there's a lot that people can do if they just reach out to folks that they know, reach out to a couple of programmers here and there, and put together some initiatives. I think these sorts of things will take off and will be adopted once people sort of get the ball rolling on them and figure out what works and you know how we can overcome some of the difficulties that we're encountering.
And I think right there is the burning torch of hope, because I just was talking about this. You look at history, and some of the most beautiful literature was born out of Chaucer, who grew up after Black Death and was six when half of Europe was taken away. And this informed and inspired his writing. All that has been born out of a purgative trial.
That's right.
That phrase, necessity is the mother of invention. And so this, what you're talking about, won't just benefit us for the here and now, but think of the implications when you mentioned the epidemic of loneliness, how this might bless people in the future to have access to these things long after this pandemic is gone.
That's right. I mean, I think one domain of social life that we're going to see radical revisions of is probably education. And irony of ironies, the homeschoolers were way ahead of the curve. You know, they're hitting all of this in stride right now because they know what to do when the kids are at home and one has to educate them. So I find that sort of pleasantly amusing. At the same time, I'm very, very concerned about all the public school kids who may have nothing right now, right? The private schools get online, they get up to speed, they figure out how to use Google Classroom or other technologies to continue delivering education to their students. But with the public schools, you know, many of their kids don't have a computer at home. And so there's a lot of kids out there right now languishing without access to any education. And we've got to think of creative ways to help them. And, you know, the people that have been doing homeschooling for the longest are probably in the best position to know how to deploy some solutions, some ready-made solutions quickly that may actually improve the quality of their education. The homeschool curricula are likely head and shoulders above most of the public school curricula anyways. And so I think this is an opportunity for a lot of creativity, for some breaking down of barriers and silos, and for recognizing that some people who were seen as sort of backwards looking are actually were probably very forward looking in many respects. So it'll be interesting.
I can hear the collective applause of the homeschool parents that are just, yes, finally. And I think there, because we continue to learn from one another, and I think there's the beauty. Well, you talked about families, and one aspect I wanted to discuss was the parents, the doctors, the nurses who are putting up a strong front in front of their patients, their family, their children. And I think it's been amazing to see the heartwarming stories. I think right now that's a big part of what's keeping us going, but it does take a toll. Do you have any stress management coping techniques that might help?
I have several. For people that are still working and working around the clock, we need creative solutions to help them rest. So at my own hospital, for example, we've devised what are sometimes called skeleton crew schedules. So we have fewer people on for longer shifts so that we're exposing fewer people. But then when you're off, you may be off for a longer period of time. And because there's fewer people here at any given time, there may be more people getting a rest or a break at home. So again, in many respects, professionally for healthcare workers, we're throwing out or rewriting the rule books. And again, I think leaders in healthcare need to be open to creative solutions. Now, for the folks that aren't in healthcare and aren't working overtime right now and maybe have dialed back on their professional work and want to know what they can do to help, I think most folks know someone. They're 1 or 2 degrees separation away from someone who works in healthcare. And it sounds simplistic and it sounds like maybe not very much, but I can tell you, you know, myself and from my other colleagues in medicine and other areas of healthcare, that those text messages, those shows of support and solidarity, those shows of appreciation actually do go a long way to help us remember why we're doing what we're doing. Just to know that one's work is appreciated, that people acknowledge it. You know, healthcare workers are stressed. We're afraid that if we go outside the lines of usual or normal care in these times, which we will have to do to some extent, that, you know, rogue district attorneys and rogue trial attorneys are going to come after us later and say, you know, why didn't you abide by the usual standard of care when you were trying to deliver telemedicine or when you were trying to triage patients in an overwhelmed ER? So we have the ordinary stress of caring for people and the ordinary stress of people second guessing how we did our best in these troubled times down the road. So, you know, just having friends, family, friends of friends reach out and say, hey, we're thinking about you. Hey, we're praying for you. Is there any way we can help? That goes a long way.
How about keeping our world small? When I think of myself as a parent and, again, trying to hold it together for my kids, I struggle with the magnitude of this whole thing worldwide, globally, but I also then am reminded that at some point I need to turn the headlines off and I need to focus on the small world in front of me, which is my children, my home. Yeah. How important is that for us to keep that perspective?
I think the right balance at home is very, very important. We have some emerging evidence that too much watching of the news is bad for your mental health and can have a kind of secondary traumatic effect, not the same kind of effect it would have if you were experiencing those events firsthand. But
and we've never had a 24-hour news cycle until such recent modern history. And now all hours of the, you get up at 2 a.m, you can't sleep, you are on a news feed, you wake up in the morning. So I do think that we were never really meant to be plugged in 24/7 like an IV to the news.
That's right. And look, some people have to be. If you're involved in pandemic triage planning at your hospital, you got to be watching the numbers every day and you got to be counting the ventilators every day. I am involved in that work, so I know the stress that doing that can cause, but even people like that need a break from it. And I would say most people, it would be very helpful to limit your news consumption to a brief period of time in the morning, not to consume too much before bed, to set a strict time limit or number of articles limit every day. And if you find that it's still stressing you out, then doing some media fasting every other day, or do a fast for 2 or 3 days to kind of hit the reset button before you go back and turn on CNN or look at your Twitter feed or whatever it's going to be. Balance in the daily schedule is very important for people right now. And I think one of the sort of universal recommendations that we can make to folks that are either working from home or furloughed at home or trying to manage a family at home is to make a daily schedule, not a rigid schedule that you follow sort of slavishly, but a certain time that you're getting up so that you're not binge watching Netflix until 1 a.m. and then sleeping until 10, you know, going to bed at a reasonable time, getting up at a reasonable time, even if you don't have to go to work, some time every day set aside for prayer, some time every day set aside for work, and maybe some home improvement projects that have been on the back burner for a while. Or if you're raising kids, you're going to have plenty of things to do in that regard. But then also making time for fun, making time for relaxation, making time to turn off all of the devices and, you know, go outside in the backyard. And I know I have to take my own medicine here because I'm working around the clock at the hospital and with the University of California system to try to prepare for the potential of triage planning. And that's taken a toll on me. It's taken a toll on my own family. I'm actually spending less time with my family now than I used to before the pandemic. So I think all of us need to kind of examine what we're doing with our time and try as best we can under the circumstances to come to some sort of reasonable balance, a kind of small daily Sabbath, and then certainly a weekly Sabbath where we turn things off, we turn the volume down on what's being piped into our homes. We're not designed by God to be tied into screens 24/7. And so we're, on the one hand, I'm advising people to use technology and use screens to stay connected with other people. And that's a good thing. But at the same time, don't go overboard with those things. We know, especially for adolescents, that too much screen time has an impact on their mental health. Things like depression and anxiety can actually be exacerbated for teens spending too much time on social media. So yes to face-to-face, real-time video connection. I would say no to too much Instagram, Snapchat, Twitter, those kinds of social media technologies, which can actually be more stress-inducing than they are a real form of social connection.
There's a great book. It's called A Time to Die by Nicola Daya, and he writes about monks on the threshold of death. And it's in France where he visits many different monasteries and talks to monks about the natural cycle of life and death. And one of the things he says in the book, we talk to Father Joseph Fessio, the founder of Ignatius Press, in the next episode, and he talks about this, that in the book, he says, we have forgotten how to die because we have forgotten how to live. And I think that it's such a close connection. And so it sounds like what you're saying is we just step by step, breath by breath, day by day, remember how to live. And yes, it's not ideal and it's in the midst of great tragedy, but the routine you pointed out, prayer, work, self-care, making time for fun is essential in showing us again simple things.
Mm-hmm. That's right. There's a modern saint who I think there's a period of his life where there's a very good example of how to do this. I've learned a lot from Saint Jose Maria Escriva, who was a Spanish priest. And during the Spanish Civil War, as many of our listeners probably know, there was a lot of violent anti-clericalism, and priests and bishops in Spain were being literally murdered. And so he had to hide out for a period of several months in the Honduran consulate. He had a friend who had a connection there. And so there were wall-to-wall people in this consulate that were hiding out because they were Catholic or because they were targets for other political reasons. And he and several of the other early members of Opus Dei that he was staying there with decided that they were not going to waste their time while they were there. So many people there were getting depressed, demoralized. They were listless and bored and sort of sitting around doing nothing all day because they couldn't move. There was barely any space to walk around. There was one bathroom for 100 people. And San Jose Maria said, no, we're going to make a schedule. We're going to get up at a set time. There were times where he didn't have bread and wine to celebrate Mass. And during those times, he would celebrate what he called a dry Mass, which was everything but the consecration. And a lot of folks are doing the same thing now via video conferencing, live stream Masses, right, where it's time for communion. We can make a spiritual communion and know that our Lord can give us that grace through extra sacramental means. But then they would have time every day set aside for study, studying foreign languages, for prayer, for work such as it could be done in those circumstances. And by making that kind of daily plan of life, they were able to see that time not just as, you know, we're holed up in these tight quarters waiting for these months to pass so that we can get back to real life, but rather we're doing our best under the circumstances to make good use of this time, maybe even seeing it as an opportunity to do things that with our ordinary work we wouldn't have time for. So maybe it is time to start that blog that I've been thinking about, or finish that article that I've always wanted to write, or get to that home improvement project that I've been meaning to get to for the last 3 years and just couldn't find time for. So it's very easy to see this only as a crisis, only as something that we have to sort of grit our teeth, hunker down, and get through, which in a sense it is. But we can also try to shift our perspective and see it as a potential opportunity. Right. My oldest son is home from college. I didn't expect to be able to spend this semester with him because ordinarily he would be in a different state. But this is a wonderful opportunity. I would challenge our listeners to try to ask themselves, how can I not just see this as a challenge, a difficulty, or even a crisis, but how can I try to reframe this to connect with my immediate family that's under the same roof in ways that I haven't before? And, you know, I've seen stories out there of family reunions of 50 people on Zoom. That family reunion might not have happened without the coronavirus lockdown. So it's important, while we don't sort of minimize or trivialize the difficulties that many of our listeners and their families are going through, I think it is fair to say that there are also some hidden opportunities and some hidden gems in here that pray about it and try to look at it with a supernatural perspective, we'll see God is allowing this for a reason. And it's up to each one of us in prayer, in conversation with Christ, to discover what is that for me? What is God trying to trying to alert me to by means of this period of suffering and purgation.
So I want to do some cognitive calisthenics, because I feel like that's what you're giving us here, is you're helping us get our minds right to shift, to orient ourselves to hope and to purpose and to function. What can I do? Like you said, take a language lesson or a hobby or get that blog going. And as we prepare our bodies to disinfect and we quarantine and self-isolate and all of that, I do think it's important to do the same with our minds. And one aspect that I want to touch on is in the event that we are alone, and this is something that we had a family sit down with our children and discussed, what were to happen if one of us were to become ill and need to go to the hospital, God forbid, and in the event that we would need to be alone. And we wanted to be very direct, of course, age appropriate with our children, but to talk to them about, look, you will never be alone. And if Dad and I are alone, do not fear for us, because God is in every beat of our heart. He is in the scriptures that you have memorized. He is in the people that are caring for you. Offer up your suffering. You know, we were really trying to prepare our children psychologically so that when they are, if God, again, God forbid, in that, because that's what you're hearing, is that grandma's there and visiting and then she gets sick and you can't see her. And it's terrible. The rite of the funeral isn't happening, which we know also psychologically is very important for closure. And so I think it can be very scary for even believers, even those mature in their faith, because you are not just afraid for yourself, but your children. How bad is this going to get? Can you help us prepare mentally to not be afraid and to maybe view it in insight that will give us encouragement?
Yeah. So I have a good friend, elderly individual, who just lost his wife a few days ago. She's been on hospice. And so we have been having these conversations the last couple of days. You know, we're likely not going to be able to have a burial service or a memorial service together in person for her. What can we do in the meantime? You know, we'll get together and memorialize her when all of this blows over. But right now, when people are grieving, how can we connect? Again, using some of these technologies. I really like what you said about preparing your children for the possibility of being hospitalized, that the best psychological preparation for that is our faith, is a reminder of an awareness of our divine filiation, that I am never alone because God is my loving Father. I'm never alone because I have a guardian angel. I'm never alone because of the communion of the saints. So this has to be very deeply rooted in us. And again, we can see this as a crisis of potential loneliness, or we can see this as an opportunity to really ask ourselves, do I believe those things? Am I praying for an increase in faith and in hope and in love so that I can be more deeply rooted in my divine filiation, in my devotion to the guardian angels, in my connection to the communion of the saints, so that if I am in the hospital, isolated from my family and my friends, I still know with the deepest kind of conviction, with supernatural faith, and by the grace of God, that I am not alone, that I can feel and sense the prayers of so many people for me, including not just my family and friends here on earth, but the angels and saints in heaven, that God is very, very close to me, and especially close to me precisely in that moment where I may not be able to be connected on a human level to other people. Again, I think this is also maybe an opportunity for apostolate, for us to show by our example and by our words what it means to be a Catholic and how that plays out in the most concrete, tangible ways in the realities of our life and in even the most difficult realities that people are facing right now, that people can look to us not because of who we are, but because of the grace that God has given us, that we can endure this with a kind of peace and fortitude that the world cannot give, and that no psychological trick on the human level could ever come close to replicating. I think it's precisely in times of suffering where people are confronted with some of the deepest questions. Does God really exist? Am I alone or am I not alone? And they're going to be looking around for answers. And many people, I think, are going to be more open to considering answers that otherwise they were too busy for, they didn't have time for, they weren't confronted with the reality of suffering and death in the ways that they are now. So this is an opportunity for Catholics, for our fellow Christians, for the church to be a light in the time of darkness, not drawing attention to ourselves, but just doing what we do with naturalness, total reliance on God. And if we do that, this will be a time of conversion.
What about the person with no belief system who is freaking out? You are a practitioner. You treat people of all faith traditions and no faith. How do you approach that? Because there are some that are thinking, I don't want your prayers, and let's do something that's more of an action step, even though we know prayer is action. But what would you say to the person who's trying to comfort someone that really isn't a believer?
Yeah, so I have encountered, I can't think of a single example, Brooke, of someone that I've encountered, even if they're atheist or agnostic, who has rejected my offer to pray for them. So I think most people, if you say, I'm going to pray for you, you know, they might roll their eyes, and they may internally be thinking, well, you know, that's kind of a waste of time. But they do appreciate the thought or the gesture. And you see some secularists even saying, you know, my thoughts are with you, or I'm sending good thoughts, whatever that means. They reach for this kind of quasi-metaphysical language to try to convey this sense of solidarity that crosses various boundaries. So I think telling people that we will pray for them, to most people that means something. And again, I think in this time of crisis, most people are going to be open to the possibility that, gee, well, I'm not sure about all that mumbo-jumbo stuff, but, you know, if Brooke is praying for me, I suppose it can't hurt, right? So maybe there's something there. So I think that maybe there's something there kind of stance is going to increase during these times of crisis. People are reaching for help. They are reaching for answers. And my guess is that there's going to be a lot more openness, even among the sort of hardened atheist types, because they really don't have answers. Now, there are things that we can do for them on a human level to try to comfort and console them. I mean, there are things that we can do to reduce our chance of getting this sort of thing. We can't control this pandemic, but yeah, we can wash our hands, we can wear a mask, we can physically distance ourselves from other people, and all of that is important. But I think a lot of folks who are doing those things and trying to control things as best they can and are still very stressed when they realize they can't completely control this, are going to look around and say, why does that family seem to be able to manage this with so much more serenity and peace than I do? What is it about them? And they may dig around a little bit and discover, well, that family is rooted in a notion of divine providence, that they don't have to completely control this thing because they do what they can on the human level to, you know, that they do the sensible things and the things that are recommended from people that understand public health, but the rest of it, they're able to leave in God's hands. They know that ultimately He's in charge of this. They aren't terrified by the prospect of death. They don't want it any more than I do for themselves or for their loved ones. But somehow it doesn't terrify them in the same way it does me. And that probably has something to do with their faith and their convictions. I've met a lot of atheists, Brooke, who, while they can't bring themselves to embrace the faith, they're envious of people who can. There's a kind of strange jealousy there. And they will tell me, I wish I had your faith. I don't. I somehow can't manage to embrace that. But I wish I could. And, I mean, it seems to me that's an opening for grace right there.
As we wrap up, I want to ask about you, how we can pray for you, and what mindset you're wearing, because you are a physician and you are on the front lines and you have a family. Yeah. I'm scared for you as you're talking about this and all the stories that we're seeing coming out of practitioners who don't have PPE and nurses, and yet they're going in every day and they're laying down their life, and they maybe didn't expect this, but yet they're faithful to it. How are you processing everything?
So, thank you for asking that. I'm not sure how I'm processing everything. Things are moving so fast, and I'm just trying to keep up with by work that I don't have a lot of time to slow down. But I do know that I and my colleagues are being supported by the prayers of many people. And I think that's precisely what's sustaining me and the people that are working shoulder to shoulder with me in the clinics and in the hospitals. So please continue to pray for us. There are some social movements out there to demand a ramp up of production of adequate personal protective equipment. And if you're so inspired, I think those are good social movements to join, because this is a basic need that healthcare workers deserve as a matter of justice. So we have a duty to treat. And when, just like firefighters run into a burning building, when other people are running the other direction, so also healthcare workers took an oath to run toward the sick and to help those even with infectious diseases during a pandemic when other people are socially distancing to try to reduce their risk. So that's part of our job. At the same time, firefighters did not sign up to run into burning building with their boxer shorts on, right? We give them adequate protective equipment. We don't send them in there totally defenseless against the flames. Well, many healthcare workers in New York right now are being asked to run into the burning building with no protective equipment. And so we absolutely need to get N95 masks, gowns, gloves, these basic things that cost pennies. We need to get those things to the people who need them most. So I would encourage our listeners, without becoming partisan in this in any way, I don't think that's a political issue. I think it's just a matter of basic matter of justice and solidarity, to please encourage those who have the power to get things up and running, to work as hard and fast as possible to do that. And then my last piece of advice is take the things that you're doing now and just add a supernatural dimension to them. So the hand washing advice that we're all getting, right? Wash your hands for 20 seconds. If you actually try to do that, that takes longer than most people are used to in washing their hands. Well, you can count to 20, or you can pray in Our Father at about the pace we pray it at Mass. That's about 20 seconds, right? So pray in Our Father while you wash your hands and offer that prayer for the healthcare workers, for the sick, for those who have died from the coronavirus already or who will die in the coming months. That's a great way to take some ordinary routine act that you're doing every day, probably more times a day now than you were a few months ago, and just adding that dimension of prayer to it. Those tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of Our Fathers and Hail Marys and Memoraries storming heaven in that way will win for us the grace that we need to sustain us during these difficult times and to produce the conversions and the solidarity and the love that our society needs right now more than ever.
And what I find too is there's creativity with that from the Holy Spirit. You know, when you lay down, you talked about washing your hands. When you go to bed, thank you, Lord, I'm in my own bed tonight. There is more great than your own bed. And when you wake up and you take a shower, thank you, Lord, I can clean myself today. You know, when you're so sick and those that are in the hospital and swallowing and eating and taking a shower and going to the bathroom, these are all small miracles. And what you're saying, to offer them up, don't just go as a rote routine, but really make it a mystical experience where you're praying, you're offering up. And I love when you included the healthcare workers in that as well. So know that if you are like Moses with your arms outstretched, that when you get tired, we are holding you up with our prayers
and gratitude.
We're just so thank you in every way you have contributed to humanity, but especially now more than ever in action with what you're doing. We just thank you.
Thanks, Brooke. Appreciate that very much.
Dr. Cariotti, how can we find you online?
It's aaroncariotti.com. I'm on Twitter at @acariotti. So those are two places where you can find a link to my books, various articles I've written, other podcasts and radio interviews. So thanks for that plug.
You're welcome. God bless you. Stay safe.
You too.
Thank you again to my guest on today's program, and especially in the midst of the busyness, for him to take the time out to give an interview was a blessing. So thank you. If you have found this informative, interesting, hopefully inspiring, please share it. And thank you for taking the time to support the program. Again, Dr. Aaron Cariotti. Also, I want to let you know that the show is going to go on a bit of a spring break hiatus, and there may be some sporadic bonus episodes popping into your feed, but I will be back in May regularly. But just taking a pause from regular shows to tend to the needs of my family, their remote learning, all of that. And as Dr. Cariotti talked about developing a routine and trying to keep some sanity, that was one of the things that I identify that I really have to try to do is kind of strip back my responsibilities. So thank you for your understanding. If there's a topic or a guest in the meantime that you'd like covered, please let me know. Shoot me an email, brooke@stgabrielmedia.com. That's the easiest way to reach out. Or also via Facebook, Brooke Taylor or Good Things Radio on Instagram, Twitter, all those platforms we've got covered, and just really appreciate that connection and the support. Thank you again, and happy Easter to you, to your family. Thank you again to my producer. Please keep him and his family in your prayers as well. And may the power of the risen Christ penetrate every dark corner of this world, in our hearts, in our minds, and lift us to the dawn of a new day. God bless you, friends. Until next time, peace and love. Happy Easter.
Good Things Radio is a production of St. Gabriel Media. Adventure, encounter, evangelize. To find out more, or to schedule Brooke to speak to your group or parish, visit brooketaylor.us. That's brooketaylor.us. Good Things Radio is a production of Coming Home Studios, produced by Mark Cumming. Find out more at www.cominghomestudio.com.
Looking for exceptional coffee delivered fresh to your door? We have the answer. Our friends at Grim Bean Coffee produce small batch artisan coffee using top tier coffee beans. The coffee is roasted when you order, guaranteeing the freshest coffee possible. Check out Breadbox Roasts, a new line of Catholic themed coffees available at www.grimbeancoffee.com/breadboxmedia. Experience coffee like never before.